Today's episode of A Novel Podcast is sponsored by Audible, and today's novels are available through Audible.com's audio library. A Novel Podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. You are listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined today by my wife, Sarah, and our good friends, Jack and Sam. Today we're discussing Dracula, an 1897 gothic horror novel that was the work that introduced the world to the infamous Count Dracula. Written by Irish author Bram Stoker, it tells the story of the nefarious vampire count from Transylvania as he attempts to migrate from his remote home in the Carpathian Mountains to the more populous city of London. Fair warning to our listeners, we will be giving away spoilers for the story of this novel, so if you've not yet read the book and you don't want us to ruin it for you, turn off your radio now. Lastly, although we will be keeping the language PG-13, this novel does contain some adult themes, so parental discretion is advised. I'd like to start by asking Sam how you were introduced to the novel and what your general impressions of it were.
So I picked up Dracula right before Halloween. I'm in Texas. It stays hot forever here in Texas, but I started to get the Halloween feeling because one day it dropped below 90 degrees. And I was like, hey, it might be a good idea now that I'm sensing fall coming along to start the Halloween thing. Went to the store, and as it turns out, it was part of a display of like classic horror books. And it jumped out at me right away because I love vampire stories, but I'd never read like the OG. So I picked it up. I got it. I had every intention of reading it. And then it sat on a shelf for a little while until I got sick. And I had to go through my book collection because I read pretty quickly. I was like 2 days in being sick and bored, just bored off my rocker. And I gave it a try and I loved it. I was actually very surprised because I know a lot of novels written, you know, older novels, particularly horror novels. Since I've read so many, I can kind of see some of these tropes coming along. And I didn't really have high expectations for it because I'm like, yeah, I've read so many already, it's probably just going to be full of like cliches. I didn't know it was written in the journalistic format that it is. And man, that sucked me in. I was all about it. I was sick as a dog and staying awake like 12 hours at a time just trying to finish up because I was so into what was going to happen next. So I feel like the way the story is written versus it being, you know, a storytelling type story, it being written in these snippets of journals, it really got my attention right away, and it made the story move along at a pace that I really liked. It was definitely for me. It's quickly flown into one of my top books. Then when I went for a reread, I still enjoyed the journalistic format, but now I'm able to pay more attention to the characters. And I gotta say, some of the Van Helsing, he's off his rocker. He's definitely one that took up a good amount of dialogue. I would have liked to read his journal mixed in with everybody else's perspective, but that might be just the way he speaks. That might be a whole novel in and of itself. So,
And how about yourself, Sarah?
So I found this as a free download, a free book, I think, from the Reddit subreddit free audiobook or free books. And I thought, well, sure, I should read Dracula. And it just so happened that there was a sunny day where I found myself outside waiting for a meeting to start at work. I thought, well, it's sunny in February, I should read Dracula. I realized when I picked it up that I didn't really know what to expect. I know the vampire lore, but I wasn't sure how much of the lore came from this book and how much was from the movie based on the book or from additional vampire stories. So I thought that was kind of interesting, and I realized that I didn't really know the story that was going to be told in this book, and I sort of had it confused with Frankenstein. Like, I was picturing villagers storming a castle with pitchforks and torches at night, and that did not happen here.
Well, that also doesn't happen in Frankenstein.
Yeah, it happened somewhere. Maybe the movie? I don't know. Not real up on my lore. My monster lore.
All right, Jack, how about yourself?
Well, this is probably the only thing I'm going to be able to contribute to tonight's recording, because I read this book in 2012, and I hated it so much that I could not bring myself to read it again for this recording. I had difficulty getting through it. It just didn't hold my attention. every time Van Helsing would start on one of his very long speeches, my mind would start to drift. I would quickly lose interest. The only thing that I did really like about the book was the character of Mina. I thought that Bram Stoker was able to build a very strong, intelligent, and likable female character, which was impressive given that this book was published in 1897, I believe you said, Russ?
Mm-hmm. So. Correct.
Yeah, I thought that was impressive also. And I guess we say this all the time, I should start looking at the prevalent culture of the time, but Stoker was an Irish author, which I thought was interesting. I don't know a lot of Irish authors, although maybe I'm just not very well versed. And he was 50 years old when he wrote the book, in just around the turn of the century. So it seemed interesting that he chose a strong female character as one of the primaries. There was still a group of men who saved the day, but Mina was absolutely important, and she was one of the first ones to put the pieces together, which I thought was interesting.
I'm looking at his bio, Sarah, and it says that Bram's mother was a feminist. So I think maybe that is what lended to the character, perhaps.
Maybe.
That makes sense.
Hmm.
I wonder what a feminist in, like, the 1850s was like.
She was like, I'll show my ankles and what other.
I'm only having 9 kids, not 14.
Right, right.
I refuse to let a gang of children run my life. I shall only have 9 versus the dozen that my mother had.
A modest 9, yeah.
I shall marry at 20 instead of 12.
Oh my goodness, wait, I wrote down he was the 3rd of 7 children, so she really reined it in.
Oh yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
Now, Mina's character being a strong female lead for the time, she's still often relocated. Now, how did you feel about that? She says, I want to go on the adventure, and, shoot, I should have refreshed characters' names. What was, not Morpheus, Neo's name in this book?
I don't know enough about the Matrix. Do you mean Jonathan?
Jonathan.
Is that how we reference our characters, our main characters?
I couldn't even think of the actor's name. All I could think of was the Matrix. All I was thinking is, whoa. We'll talk about the movie. Regardless, she wants to go out on the adventure, and he says, no, I can't stand the thought of you getting hurt. I need you to stay at home where it's safe. Is that relocation, is that denial of the driver's seat, is that of the times? Is that sexism? Or is that simply somebody trying to protect their loved ones?
I guess just from the way I read it, I kind of got the more trying to protect the loved one feeling from Jonathan when the others kind of started talking a little bit about it. I mean, being that they respected Mina, they classified her of her intelligence that was as good as a man's, which we all know is the ultimate intelligence level. They did say, they respected that. They understood her. I didn't catch too much of the cuddle her because she's a lady thing. I feel like a lot of them more picked up on that because of, Jonathan, her husband, kind of saying this. And it kind of seemed like she went along with it, too. It seems like she was all right with it, especially when she got that mark on her. It kind of seemed like she was all right staying behind the scenes because she didn't want to usurp her husband's position. And, it really wasn't her ordeal until later on. Well, obviously she got pulled in later, but it was more the men's ordeal. And I didn't quite get too much of a stay out because you're a lady. I got more of that from her than I did from the men. It kind of seemed like for me.
But then eventually throughout the course of the novel, the entire party is fully wrapped up in what I'll just refer to as the adventure. There's not really anybody taking a back seat in that last parts of the novel. Was that part of the feminism, or do you think that was just a requirement of the story?
I think it was part of the feminism, because I do feel like Jonathan telling Mina to stay out of it I would disagree respectfully. I think she was told to stay out of it a bit throughout the book.
Agreed.
But I feel like Jonathan telling Mina to, you know, relax, be a nice lady, was more of a sign of the times than...
And sexism.
Well, sexism, but I think that that was a sign of the times at that point in time.
Yeah, agreed. That's
So, yeah, today we would definitely label it sexism, but then it was more, she should be home, she should be protected and kept safe. But I really liked that Stoker brought her into the end battle and included her in that and let her have a part. But she was a key element in that final scene. And I think that was good, and I think that probably did reflect the feminism.
And on the topic of sign of the times, is there a parallel between this novel and British imperialism?
I mean, there was a lot of mentioning of foreigners. I don't know if that's the route you want to go with this conversation.
Not what I was thinking, but I also didn't want to ask a leading question. What I saw, and this was not entirely of my own ideas, but what I saw and then read in forums after reading the book was you have essentially the British Empire being essentially invaded by foreigners and shoving them out and pushing them back and then bringing their own culture along back to the Carpathian Mountains to get rid of what originated from that area.
I mean, yeah, that's what they do. I would agree with that.
Okay. Well, to go back then, Jack, to your original complaint about, I suppose I could simply say what a slog this novel was for you. It is an extraordinarily slow burn. We're 2/3 the way through the novel before anyone even realizes it's a vampire.
It's just Van Helsing. I just wanted him to shut up the whole time. It's just like, stop talking. That's enough. Shut up.
Like, we get it. You guys are friends. We don't need to talk about being friends and the length of time we're friends and how deep of friends we're going to become in the future and how friendly of friends we're going to be. Because we're going to friend. Like, the way he really, really managed to harp on, like, the smallest detail. Like, it just managed to turn into pages and pages of just Van Helsing going along.
Rambling.
Yeah, and at first I kind of got a kick out of him because he's just so much. Like, he's so overdone and so theatrical. But eventually, you know, I guess kind of like that friend in person. That's, you know, they're entertaining for a little while, but a while, you know. They carry on just too much. I could have done with a little less Van Helsing, but he might have been hard. Might have been hard to omit, considering he's the expert, you know.
Well, did you see that maybe there was a little too much wordiness, too much repetition, and that can be exemplified well in the fact that those girls had 4 blood transfusions, and it seemed like each one was just a repeat of the last. Oops, we forgot to lock the door. Oops, we forgot to put the flowers up. Oops, we were home an hour late.
Oh man, we told her mom to sit here all night, and she just didn't. She thought we were lying. I thought that was
garlic not much. Smelled bad, so yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the opening portion of the novel, probably the first third, when Jonathan is going to visit Dracula, I thought it was fantastic. I was completely enthralled.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the mythos was interesting. I thought there's no way he's going to get out of here. So that entire portion that took place in Dracula's castle, I thought was fantastically well done. If you had ended the book there, I would have been very satisfied. Maybe just cut out all the middle bit and had the epic battle at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I could agree with that.
But, yeah, you're right. They had, like, 4 blood transfusions. And is that even something we could do in the 1800s?
Well, you know, universal donors.
Right, so they just happened. That's where I was.
I think you can assume... I think you can safely assume that what they're saying, as far as scientifically, is that she's a universal recipient.
Is that a thing?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes.
There's one who can take any type, and there's another who can give to any one.
Didn't find out the types of bloods until, like, years later? Yes.
No, I mean, it's not like Van Helsing went and said, okay, let's make sure it's going to work. I think it just...
it just happened.
That's the assumption. Looking at it from this angle, that's the assumption you have to make.
It just coincidentally, she turned out to be a universal recipient.
That's absolutely my headcanon on this, but But I had recently listened to the stuff you should know on blood typing, and I was like, this can't, nope, this is a bad idea, guys. You gotta stop. It's gonna coagulate. She's gonna die extra.
Sarah, this is kind of like an Outlander where all the other doctors just, you know, the bloodletting, because it solves everything.
Right. We should just do this. It'll be fine.
But I think Stoker was trying to go for some kind of significance with the blood transfusions, because doesn't she get a transfusion from one of each of the men?
I think so, yeah.
So that really ties her together as the centerpiece of the group. Okay. So there's a reason he did it, it just didn't kind of... The reason doesn't subtract...
You need some headcanon with it.
It doesn't really lessen the absurdity of the whole scenes.
No, I thought that was neat, because he did stress that each of the men had a tie to her outside of that, and, in addition, each literally gave their own blood for her.
So true.
I thought that was, like, an interesting element.
So, why is it that we don't see any journal entries from Arthur or Quincy?
Maybe the novel was just long enough. I don't know.
They're
That's
illiterate.
A good question. Maybe they're illiterate.
It kind of seems like the novel focused on the journals are written from Dracula's victims, almost. I mean, John Harper was almost a victim.
Yep, that's
Lucy's
a good point.
Lucy's diary was included. She's a victim. Mina, obviously, she's a victim. It kind of seems like it, yeah, I mean, we didn't get a journal. I don't remember us getting a journal entry from Van Helsing. I know we got some notes from, like, oh, here's some notes from the shipping company that moved the dirt boxes or whatever. But it seems like the majority of this is not told through... The hero, well, maybe kind of the heroes, but they're not really told through that. It's more told through the victim of Dracula.
That's maybe interesting.
To me, it feels scarier that way. You're seeing it through the victim's eyes. You're not seeing it through powerful Van Helsing who's coming along to slay him. And you're not seeing it through, you know, love, the people who were in love with Mina and wanted to propose to her. You're seeing it, it's a horror novel. You're seeing it from the people who were most affected by it and are the likeliest to tell a vivid story, to give you a story that's going to scare you because this happened to them and it scared them. So that's what I got from that, because I did notice that myself. I honestly was, when I saw it was written in journalistic format, I thought we might get a little journal entry from everybody, like you said, from Arthur, one from Quincy, maybe a little bit from Van Helsing. I thought maybe we'd get a little bit of everything, but as we were moving towards the close of the novel, I kind of scratched my head and thought to myself, did we hear from anybody else besides Mina? And flipped back through and was like, oh yeah, well there was, I know we read Jonathan at the beginning, but did we hear from anybody else? I saw Lucy, and, you know, I did see the others who were involved. Pretty much, we didn't see much from them, even though they were main players as well. So it seems the scary part is probably going to come from the people that this happened to, and maybe that was a motivation behind setting it up that way. And, you know, my thoughts are,
I think that's an excellent perspective. But you bring up an interesting point when you're saying this is a horror novel. Did you find this novel to be particularly scary?
Well, no.
No. Well, I as Sarah said, I really enjoyed the first part, but no.
Ah, yes.
I thought that the scene that Stoker set up with Jonathan in the carriage ride going to the castle was really good.
Yeah.
Very suspenseful. I mean, it could have turned into a real horror there. Hmm. Like, I took a lot of notes at that part because I was really excited. I thought this was great. But all of the townspeople, like, saying to him, do you know where you're going and what you're going to do? And the innkeeper's wife gave him a crucifix, and he was like, no, I don't do that. And she was like, do it for your mother. Creepy.
Yeah.
And the carriage driver was driving at breakneck speed up the cliff, and then you find out we think he was driving that fast so that Jonathan would not be able to meet up with Dracula. They would get there first and be like, oh, well, he's not here, we have to leave. Oh, geez, sorry, guess you can't go stay in this spooky haunted castle for the night. Bummer, we just saved your life. Let's go. I thought that scene, that portion of the book was just really well done and painted a fantastic picture. And I was sitting in metropolitan D.C. in a concrete jungle in the sunshine and was still kind of creeped out by what I was reading.
The female vampires, too.
Yeah, they were kind of creepy. And, I think initial Dracula was scary. Like, when you first meet him in the castle, and when you're just first learning something's off. I think that was well handled. Really? Maybe it's Van Helsing that brings this whole thing down.
Oh, it totally is. It totally is.
Van Helsing in my mind is so much cooler than Van Helsing in the book. I think I have him associated with... Mm-hmm. Isn't there a Castlevania character based on Van Helsing?
There's a whole movie called Van Helsing.
I didn't watch that. I'm bad at movies.
There's a TV series. Like, Van Helsing has been the star of a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, because that dude rambles and kind of carries on quite a bit.
Okay, but he's really cool in all the things he's the star of, right?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, the idea of him is kind of cool. Like, this guy who's an expert on monsters and lore and religion and has all this, you know, all this guts to go out there and really
hunter.
Dude, yeah, this is like an awesome concept, and then you meet him and it's kind of like, really?
Oh, he just keeps talking.
Yeah.
You have to help slay vampires, because you've been here talking for like 45 minutes, so.
Somebody definitely moved your bulbs of garlic, and you're going to have to give her another blood transfusion in the time you've taken to explain this to me.
Serious. And, you know, I really, as much as I like Van Helsing as a character, I did, like I said, get tired of the rambling on, but we definitely needed him to pull stuff together. I liked the scene in the graveyard where they're talking about beheading and the garlic, and like, yes. He's really all about getting in there, and he's like, look, this needs to be done. We gotta do it. Are you gonna do it? I'll do it if you want. Like, it's, to me, that was him as a character is really cool. The scenes that are set up in the book are really cool. Maybe just because the book's a little dated, you know. Maybe back in the 1890-something, Van Helsing would have been the guy to be back.
I was thinking that myself. Yeah,
you know?
When I was getting a little fed up with him, the dialogue, I thought maybe, like, is this something that would have been sought out at that point in time?
Yeah, maybe it was really cool to be verbose and use as many words as you possibly could to describe a small thing. Maybe that was in back then, you know?
Well, is it also possible that it's simply the style of the novel, that if this were to happen in real life, these guys would be hemming and hawing about it for hours on end, and Bram Stoker just doesn't truncate that quite as much as modern authors might?
That was, yeah, borderline what I was also thinking. Is this just the style of the time?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I could see that.
Now, regarding the ending, what did you guys think of the ending? In particular, like, the moment at which it really does come to a head and they meet Dracula and his wagons on the pass.
I mean, I would have expected Dracula, just from his description and some of the other stuff that was going on, to have cut a little bit scarier of a figure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really seem all that scary once we got to know him. He kind of got taken out by these dudes. You know, they had a plan, they executed it. It seemed like they managed to overtake him, in my opinion, you know, fairly well for somebody who's been around as long as he has been and is of super strength. It didn't seem like it took as huge of a conflict to bring this super powerful vampire down as what I would have thought it had.
Well, I think that's kind of the point of the vampire. It's that as long as they're on their home turf, as long as they have the advantages that they need, they're nigh unstoppable. But when you can check them in some kind of a situation where they don't have their retreats that they're looking for, they really are weak and frail and
just
easy to take advantage of.
A pale old man.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was neat. Was it 50 coffins of his dirt?
Home soil.
That he had delivered to random spots in London, and they had to sort of chase around and... what were they? Holy water in the coffin? Eucharist in the coffin.
And that kind of... I think that concept of being able to use the body of Christ to sanctify the ground and make it impossible for the vampire to use is a neat theme. But it seems to me like, wouldn't it be kind of easy for him to hire somebody to go in and take it out? Or do you think that just corrupts the ground?
Nah, they crumbled it up. He's
not able to get back in.
They sprinkled the little...
Oh, I suppose that's true, yes.
Eucharist dust in there.
That's a dumb question, then.
But, yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the fun of reading any sort of horror novel is, well, if this guy had just done this one thing, if he had just turned that light on, everything would be fine.
Mm.
If he had just buried one coffin, no one would have found it. One of the other interesting elements that I remember from the book is, I don't believe it was Van Helsing, but it was one of the adventure guys who recorded their notes on a phonograph, and they were wax records, and then they were destroyed in the heat. I think it was a fire. But I thought that was a neat image, and it made me wonder how common that practice was during the time period where the book was written. Did a lot of people have voice recorders at that point?
So one of the other themes that you see often, or I suppose you see overarching this story, is the theme of the underdog. We have the strength of determination within man, like Jonathan, and asking, is that enough to overcome any adversity? Obviously, like I say, Dracula has the clear advantage through most of the novel. It's only when they really put their heads together and start digging in their heels that they're able to turn the tides. So did you see any other examples of that throughout the novel, or anything specifically that exemplifies that theme of the underdog? Nope.
Do we still have them?
Yeah, someone's giggling. All right, so I'll ask this then. Dracula is a story that is so often referenced and parodied that you probably felt, just like Sarah did, going into this, that you know everything you already need to know about it. So the question is, before you were actually exposed to the true novel in its original form, you had expectations. Did the novel meet those expectations?
I feel like it did not. It's like an anti-Van Helsing club over there.
I'm probably going to say it five more times before we hang up.
I mean, for me, it surpassed my expectations because, like I said a minute ago, going in, I really didn't have high expectations for Dracula. I thought it was honestly going to be kind of, like I mentioned a minute ago, like filled with a bunch of tropes that I've seen a million times over, but this one's going to be like ultimate corniness because it's the first one. You know, I really didn't anticipate it being all that great. I just kind of thought, I've seen better horror since this has been written. I've probably seen, you know, just because I like vampires and I enjoyed the Anne Rice books. Vampire Lestat's like my thing. I really, you know, enjoyed him as a character. I just felt like I wasn't going to get a whole lot out of Dracula. And then, like I said, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great, you know, even though I had seen some of the stuff, you know, before with the superhuman powers and being able to kind of hypnotize people, it was done in a clever way. As I started reading it, I was like, you know, this is not only surpassing my expectations, I can see why people base their vampires off of Dracula. I can see why this has inspired more vampire novels. I can understand why it's been remade and why, you know, playing Dracula as a character can make an actor famous. I understand it now. It makes more sense to me now that I've read it and gone all the way through it. A little while there, it was kind of dragging in the middle, and it was meeting those expectations that I had for being a little bit dated. But, you know, overall, like I said, I really feel like it surpassed what I had going in there. There were very few instances where I was like, yep, this is definitely showing its age and the sign of the what I'm reading is a sign of the times. But for the most part, it still holds up. It holds its own alongside many other vampires that have been written since then. And I definitely say Dracula's a better vampire than like the Cullens were. So, you know, I'm with him.
I appreciated that a lot of the vampire lore that I knew was in the novel. Garlic and the crucifix, body and blood of Christ.
Moving water.
Mm-hmm. You have to, you had to behead them or stake in the heart to kill them. So I was kind of impressed that all of that lore has held true.
Yeah.
Throughout time. An interesting note, we were talking about the movies briefly. The first film was in 1922, so about 25 years after it was written. And Bram Stoker's widow sued the filmmakers because she was given no notice of filming and no permission for them to use the story. And then she eventually won the suit, and all but one copy of the original film was destroyed.
Well,
I thought
why
that was
would
kind of some neat lore.
Why would they ask her permission? She's just a woman. What does she know?
Fair enough.
Why would they bother?
She knew enough to sue.
She knew. She figured it out,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, girl. Yeah. And she won.
Guess they underestimated Mrs. Stoker.
Say, my mother-in-law was a feminist.
Right. But I thought that was kind of an interesting... Like, in 1922, you could just make a movie from a story and not worry about that. But I guess you did need to worry about it. She sued and won, so that's the takeaway there.
All right, so
my favorite movie, of course, is the 1992 version, because not only do we have Gary Oldman, but we also have Tom Waits.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Keanu was in that one, too.
I don't think
Anthony
I've
Hopkins,
ever...
Anthony Hopkins, Winona Ryder.
I don't think I've ever watched a Dracula movie.
No, me neither.
I'm a huge Tom Waits fan.
I like Tom Waits. We might have to check that out.
Who did Tom Waits play?
Renfield.
I see. So speaking of Renfield, what was the significance of Renfield? We mentioned Renfield in the previous episode. It was very similar to in the story It, when Henry Bowers was in jail and was talking to the moon. You have Renfield in this asylum talking to the night sky. But what was his significance? Was he just being influenced by the Count? The Count was pushing him to consume life? What did you think? Was he just there just to be weird?
He definitely was weird. I don't know if that was his sole purpose. I don't think it was his sole purpose. I thought he was a neat character. I liked the way that he was written and that he would start with really small animals, start with flies, and then graduate up. I forget how big he got in the end.
Did he get a cat, or was he just asking for a cat?
He was asking for what? He was asking for cat. He got as big as worms.
He definitely got the birds.
He got birds, yeah, right?
He stopped at birds, yeah. He got flies, then spiders, then birds.
I thought he was an interesting character. I don't know.
I mean, do you think the consuming of the life is you know, parallel to Dracula?
Yeah.
That's
I mean,
what I was getting.
Wondering if he was just there to provide a juxtaposition to, like, Lucy and Mina, who were being taken over but didn't want to be taken over, and Renfield was being taken over but was okay with it. And then maybe his death shows that Dracula really was evil. So he had a willing servant, a willing minion, but destroyed him in the end.
Mm.
In a pretty inconsequential way. If I'm recalling correctly, I don't think it gave Dracula any particular advantage, right?
Yeah.
He just did it because he could.
For some reason, I kind of got the vibe, and I don't know if it's just something that I was reading, and I blew through it kind of quick, so I can't remember if it's something that I read in the book itself, or it was just the feeling that I got, but it almost felt like Renfield got hungry for animals when Dracula was getting thirsty. That's
possible.
Almost like there was like a parallel, almost like he was, like how Mina could go into Dracula's consciousness or however that worked out when she was hypnotized.
Yes.
I almost felt like Renfield was on that same level, but since maybe he was cracked to begin with, maybe he had some issues to start with, then all of a sudden he comes into, you know, to the supernatural presence and it just affected him. His interaction with Dracula, being that he was already mentally ill, it affected him a little bit differently than it would affect your standard person. It almost seemed like he immersed himself, even though he felt bad about it and he knew, you know, he had an attack of conscience. It almost seemed like he immersed himself in, you know, his delusions and that thirst for consumption, a quote, consumption of life, you know, with the bugs and the desire to, you know, eat the birds and all. It almost seems like it was, maybe influenced by Dracula's thirst, that same thirst that he gets when he drinks blood and consumes life or whatever. It almost seemed like they were happening, maybe not at the same time, but in my mind, I fixed it that way. Like, okay, he's eating bugs at the same time. Dracula's probably, like, sipping on Lucy. Or maybe he was getting those vibes that when Lucy was the beautiful lady, you know, sucking from kids, sucking blood from kids, maybe Renfield's, you know, feeling those vibes, and that's when he gets hungry, too. But he's not hungry for blood. He's hungry for life force, and since he's in a limited capacity, this is how he was beginning to fulfill that. That's just kind of like what I was feeling. I really like Renfield as a character. He creeped me out too. I guess that's why I was calling it a horror novel, because the beginning setup in the castle, yes, that definitely gives you the creepiness. But right along the way, you've got some scenes in graveyards where you're beheading corpses. You got a crazy dude eating bugs and birds. Like,
you're right.
You know, all along the way, he's kind of a, you know, it's definitely for me, like I said, it's a horror book, but I really enjoyed him as a character. I enjoyed coming back around to reading about, you know, his antics and what he would, what zany adventures he would get up to next.
Mm-hmm. I think I agree with you. If you are more selective about the, this sounds kind of, if you're more selective about the scenes that you pay attention to, and maybe it's just our attention span today versus the attention span of the average reader, you know, 100 or so years ago. Mm-hmm. I will admit that I skipped large chunks of Van Helsing's dialogue, and I felt like the novel moved a lot better that way. We're back to some more action. We're in a graveyard. We're beheading people. Somehow this guy can slip through a crack under the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was some creepy stuff happening here. Even if you look at it, like if you take yourself out of the scene at the beginning, is so powerful. The fear that you're getting from Jonathan Harker and the unknown and the creepiness. And I could smell the damp basement he was going into, the damp cellar he was going into from the vivid imagery that was at the beginning. It felt like that tapered off a little bit. For some of the other horrifying scenes, I feel like those could have been set up very similarly, but, you know, we were listening to Van Helsing's expertise, so, you know, we had to let the expert go, you know, and do his thing. Those other scenes really feel like they could have been written a little bit, you know, they could have stood out a little bit more if we could kind of edit a little bit of the prose that was coming out of Van Helsing.
All right, so that does bring up another good question, and that is the Count pure evil? Or is it just that he's a man who's been corrupted by some kind of evil force? Some of the more detailed questions would be, why is it that holy objects are able to ward him off? And why is it that he and the weird sisters are pushing some kind of a sexual advancement? Dracula, of course, only drinks the blood of women, but at the same time he says to the sisters, he is mine, in reference to Jonathan. What was his purpose there?
I mean, maybe Jonathan was, maybe he was pretty. I mean, maybe he just looked good that day. He had his good suit on. He was ready to go meet the Count. You know, maybe he was just like, this one's mine. Ladies, go find your own.
Okay.
Well, I thought it was interesting because it almost seemed as if Dracula had a special plan for Jonathan in the beginning.
Yeah.
He was specifically invited to the castle with the letter, the written invitation. And then when they got to the castle, you know, Dracula throws the door open wide and says, this is my home, please enter freely. It definitely seemed like Jonathan was being set up for something, and then I felt like we didn't find out what the something was. I mean, in the end, Jonathan linked to Lucy and Mina. But was he just looking for Jonathan to be an agent for his move to Europe? But then Jonathan wasn't the agent, if I recall correctly, right? Do you think he was eliminated as the agent because he became suspicious?
Could be.
But Dracula trapped him in the castle, so of course he's going to be suspicious. If you had just played it cool, Dracula, you could be everywhere right now. You had to tip your hand early, though, man.
Hmm. I mean, going back to the, you know, the original question, is Dracula evil or is he not? I guess it would kind of just depend on... It depends. If we're talking about in 1897 when this novel was written... Dracula was certainly evil. That was a time when we were a bit more religious, you know, here and overseas, over the, you know, the other side of the pond. They were a bit more religious. Religion played a larger role, hence the crucifixes being, you know, a ward against him and the holy water being a ward against him. Dracula at the time was definitely set up as a character for evil. I think that's what it was supposed to be. But now looking at the story the way it's written, if we're looking at it through a modern lens, I'm not so sure. I kind of almost picture Dracula as an animal, almost. He's just living. He's just moving his habitat around the best way that he can. He's just feeding himself the best way that he can. I guess it just kind of depends whether or not it seems like he's getting true enjoyment out of that.
I don't know. He seemed like he enjoyed messing around and tormenting, especially Harker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was sort of six of one, half dozen of the other. A, this is just the creature that he is, and this is how he needs to live. But B, he definitely enjoyed the game.
Mm-hmm. And just doesn't mean just because he had to live that way doesn't mean he couldn't have fun while doing it.
Right, right.
So in that way, do you see a parallel between the two potential sides that Dracula could be and what actually came out between Lestat and Louis?
Ooh, I never thought about it like that.
I mean, Dracula could run out into the woods and just drink deer's blood.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to live it up. He doesn't have to move to London.
That's true.
Maybe he liked the top hats. I assume they wore top hats.
I'm sure they had deer in jolly old England. they definitely had rats.
I was just going to say that.
Okay, so to compare this to other works and some of the influences it has, I caught a lot of little references that I'm just going to spit all of them out right now and then throw it open for anybody else to add to that list. First, one of my favorites was just hearing the Carpathian Mountains, knowing that the villain from Ghostbusters 2, Viggo the Carpathian, was a very Dracula-like character. They take a train ride on the Orient Express, which of course we read that novel a few last year. Mina also talks about ships sailing towards the storm, and I believe even quotes as idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean, which is, of course, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. There's also some Harry Potter influence in here. The Weird Sisters is what their female vampires are referred to as in Dracula, and that's the name of the pop group, the Wizarding pop group. In addition to that, Mina eventually gets a scar on her forehead and has a telepathic link to the Count. And then beyond that, of course, there's heavy influences on Salem's Lot. We see a lot of the Count in, I can't remember the Dracula figure and his name in that one, but we see a lot of that. And then the story itself reminded me a lot of the movie The Woman in Black, especially the beginning part. The way Jonathan Harker had a job to do, and he has to go to a very scary place and take care of something in order to make it work, and it's important for his career and for his marriage for him to do this, is very similar to the main character. Speaking of Harry Potter, it was played by Daniel Radcliffe. The main character in The Woman in the Black kind of had to go through a very similar experience in that movie. Anybody got anything else?
Should I use this time to give one final... I've lost words.
Well, no, I wanted to say if you have any other...
Final reiteration of how much I hated
Vampire. Yeah, that's fine.
There we go.
Do you think it would have been better if he just had less dialogue? What if Van Helsing was mute? He would have been really awesome. I mean, he was kind of awesome. He just talked a lot. More than he needed to.
So then, obviously, in addition to references to other works, there have been recreations of this story. We, of course, talked about Bram Stoker's Dracula, the movie from 1992, but are there other works that specifically recreate the Dracula story using the name Dracula that you've appreciated? Anybody?
Not that I can remember specifically. I can't remember specifically if it's about Dracula, but I do remember him popping up in, like, one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. It's called The Monster Squad. I know everybody remembers The Monster Squad.
Never heard of it.
Maybe not.
You talking about that movie with Howie Mandel?
Nope, that's Little Monsters. But
yeah, Fred that's Savage a great movie.
That is an awesome movie. Fred Savage was also, he was in that, but he was also in The Monster Squad. And it's about these kids who basically, they call themselves the Monster Squad because they start discovering monsters around their town led by Dracula.
Hmm.
Dracula is the main character. He's like doing something to try and revive all the classic monsters. So you see the Creature from the Black Lagoon, you see Frankenstein, you see Wolfman, you also see as separate monsters the three Weird Sisters.
Hmm.
It was one of my favorite movies. It was really good. It was a really good movie. It had Fred Savage and one or two other guys. It's a kid's movie. So, you know, he was, you know, whatever age he was at back in the 80s when he was super popular. That's when he was in this movie. So, you know, kind of a young, maybe just before teenage years. But it was a really good movie. And that was actually my first exposure to vampires and horror in general. It was kind of done in a in a soft way, in a kid's movie style way. But even now, when I went back and saw it and, like, watched it as a grown-up, I was like, yo, this was kind of scary for kids back in the day. I don't know if I would show this to my little one now. But it was a really good movie, and he was the, you know, main baddie in that movie. And if y'all haven't seen that one, I think y'all might be missing out. It might even be on Netflix or Hulu by now. Because it's super old. It's from the 80s.
So it was like live-action Hotel Transylvania, kind
of? It was I've never seen Hotel Transylvania. But yeah, it is definitely live-action. You have the monsters in elaborate costumes. I want to say it was like four or five kids. You know, one of them's got a little sister, and they all get on these zany antics throughout the town trying to defeat the monsters that come along. But the monsters are actually really well done. Like, they're kind of creepy. They're kind of creepy.
Hmm.
80s creepy.
Yep. I tried to watch Little Monsters with my kids. They weren't having it.
They're not really into movies either. Sometimes.
Not scary movies for sure.
Definitely not. I think the only vampire things that I've seen Hotel Transylvania, two or three of them. Adam Sandler voicing Dracula is interesting, but it's okay. We read Salem's Lot,
mm-hmm.
and I read Twilight, mm-hmm. and Dracula. Mm-hmm. That's about it for me. I think it's interesting that Dracula is always the leader of the monsters, though.
Yeah, even in, you mentioned the original Castlevania. In the original Castlevania, you fight Medusa, you fight the Mummy, you fight Dracula, you fight Death. And I'm sure a host of others in the sequels. But it's Dracula who is the leader.
Yeah. It seems like he's usually, like, the head monster in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Probably with that hypnotism thing. If I could hypnotize people, I'd be running the show, too.
Mm, yep.
That is true.
And then since we mentioned Hotel Transylvania, I'll also say that... Cinemassacre did a really good video about things that people didn't actually say in movies. Either they were misquoted, or they were never actually quoted, or he broke it up into many categories and cited many examples. And of course, one of them is, I don't say blah, blah, blah.
I didn't hear him say that, no.
I want to suck your blood, blah, blah,
didn't
blah.
Hear, didn't no, hear that?
No, Bela Lugosi never said that.
Really? So where did that come from? Why does everybody think that vampires say that? That Dracula said that?
He is not a sponsor of the show, but I would recommend seeing that Cinemassacre episode.
I'm going to have to check it out. Yeah. I have to check it out.
I forget what it's called, but I'm sure if you just search Cinemassacre misquoted movies, you'll find it.
I'm kind of excited about this because I like finding stuff like that. Like, you know, he really didn't say that. I'm one of those type of people.
Mm. Oh, you'll love this one. Yeah. Apparently, James Cagney never said you dirty rat either.
What?
Yep. And of course, we all know Darth Vader never said, Luke, I am your father.
Of course we know that.
He didn't say that. My mom and I had this discussion because she was around when it came out. And I was like, he didn't say that. We just mm-hmm. rewatched it.
Yeah.
And I mean, she didn't believe me, but he really didn't.
He comes close. Just like he did do this huge thing about... how Captain Kirk never said, beam me up, Scotty.
Really?
Yeah, why I mean...
this?
Well, I mean, he said just about every other combination of those words. But he never said, beam me up, Scotty. Mr. Scott, beam us up. Two to beam up, Mr. Scott. Scotty. Got three to beam up. Plenty of combinations there, but never actually the quintessential... misquoted line.
Now I know.
All right, so does anybody else have anything to say about Dracula or any works that were influenced by the original, by Bram Stoker?
I got nothing. I'm just happy it came along because vampires are some of my favorite characters to read about. They're always so interesting. So, yay Dracula. Thanks for existing, buddy.
All right, well then I'm going to go ahead and send it around the table. Tell me a little bit more about what you've been reading, what you've been doing lately, and of course we're going to have to discuss what we're going to be doing next on the podcast. I'd like to start with Sam, and I'd like to ask the loaded question. Sam, have you read The Passage?
I have not.
You
I
must.
I have not read The Passage. Why? What is this? What is this?
Well, it's vampire, postal apocalyptic, brilliant novel.
those are all buzzwords that are getting my attention because I like vampires and I like post-apocalyptic. So yeah, I'm on it. I'm writing it down now. So now you know what is going to be on my reading list.
Good. All right. So tell us what else you've been up to lately and what you've been reading.
Well, I've been reading, I'm stuck on Philip Pullman right now. He wrote the, his Dark Materials trilogy, the Amber Spyglass, the Golden Compass.
Right.
He wrote those, but he recently released a new book in the same world. It's not in the same series, but it's in the same world. And it's been like 10 years since those books came out. So I was so excited. I'm reading it now. It's called The Book of Dust. And I guess it's supposed to be one of three, new ones. I just loved his Dark Materials. I read all three in the series, and then I read the extra that came along with it, and it was just absolutely amazing. It's one of my favorite go-tos. If I know I need a long book to read, I just get my set out that's got all three, and I start going at it. And then I also found out...
Actually, I have to interrupt because I have to ask a question about those books. Yeah. Aren't those atheist propaganda?
I don't know. I didn't realize it until the third book in, towards the end, when they start talking about angels and demons and several other things. I mean, I also didn't went into C.S. Lewis blindly, too, so don't take me... don't take my words and things and stuff like that for, you know, for it. I had no idea C.S. Lewis was as religious as he was and that the entire Chronicle of Narnia was an allegory for something else entirely. Until, like, the last five pages of the last book, and then all of a sudden the light bulb clicks on, and I'm like, oh my god, did this mean something else? So I didn't catch, so I didn't catch the,
I asked only because I was told that that's what it was, and I said, well, I gotta see this for myself, so I read The Golden Compass, and I didn't see it, and I was not invested enough in that crusade to read any more.
Well, the Golden Compass is actually the second book. The first one, I believe, is called The Amber Spyglass, or I might be mixing those two up. Maybe The Golden Compass was the first one.
I was pretty sure Golden Compass was the first one. Yeah. And I certainly read it, and I didn't go into it thinking, hey, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
The ending of the first one is when the main adult male and female open the gate, right?
I can't remember, because I read them all three in one novel.
Okay.
It's one. So for me, his Dark Materials was basically almost all like one book because it was this huge book that had all three of them together. I didn't catch it till the end, but that's because they didn't. If you're reading the first two books, or even halfway through the third one, I'm not completely dense, but you know, halfway through the third one, that's when they start talking a lot about angels and demons and several other things. That once you've read the ending, then you start looking at the other two books like, was there more symbolism than I thought there? So, it could definitely be. But also, having looked for this new one, the new one that was coming out, I found that he did a whole nother series that's all detective novels set in Victorian England about a female heroine, which is a totally different vein of where his Dark Materials were. So I kind of wonder... I'm not so sure if it is an atheist allegory. It might be just a story that this dude told, because the rest of his books are totally different than that, unlike Lewis, who the rest of his books are extremely religion-centric, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess if you read it that way, it could be, is my long answer, my short answer.
Okay. All right. Sounds great.
Yeah. So I was reading the, you know, that one. I'm reading another Pullman in the one of the detective novels. They're super fast paced and they're a lot of fun. Just some light reading, so that's that one's a blast to me. And I'm reading this one called Ancient Worlds, which I just found randomly on the sales clearance shelf. But I got it because it's such a dumb reason to get it. I got it because the author's name is Michael Scott, who's the dude in The Office, which cracked me up to no end. I was like, I need to hear Michael Scott's thought on Ancient Worlds. But it's nonfiction, and it's all about, like, what was happening, back in the day, but all throughout the world. Instead of focusing on one time period, it kind of says, alongside this event going on, here were these other things throughout the world happening, too, just for context of time.
Yeah, but Michael Scott's book is called Somehow I Manage.
Oh, man, I missed that one. I was all about the ancient world, a global history of
antiquity. Oh, you were about, like, a real book. I just watched too much Office.
But it cracked me up that the author's name was Michael Scott, so I was like, okay, well, I'm interested in Ancient Worlds, but, you know.
No, that sounds actually really interesting, how they link together.
Yeah, it just cracked me up because the author's name, I was like, isn't that the dude from The Office? Okay, I know it's a character, but this is still funny in my opinion, so I got it. And I actually ended up getting into it, so that's, you know, a bonus. It's nice when you get a book that you want to read, right?
Definitely.
So that's what's on my bookshelf for now. Those three are what I've been consuming for the past, like, 2 or 3 days.
All right.
Now I got the passage on my book list, too.
I believe you'll love it, and when you're done with it, we'll have to do an episode on it.
Definitely.
Jack, you still with us? You want to tell us what you've been up to lately? I didn't hear her drop off.
No, I'm here.
I'm muting.
All right, so what have you been reading lately, and what else is new in your life and up in your neck of the woods?
I am currently reading Kristen Hannah's new book, The Great Alone.
Oh.
It's really good. Kristen Hannah wrote a book, when did the
Nightingale?
The Nightingale. That came out in 2015. It was an exceptional book.
Yes.
Based on World War II and two sisters in France. This book, The Great Alone, takes place in the 70s. And it's a family. The father was a POW in Vietnam, and he's returned now, obviously has a lot of PTSD issues, and just uproots the whole family and decides to move to Alaska. And where I'm at right now, summer is just ending. They've actually had a very great couple of months. The dad seems really happy. He's finally kind of getting back to normal. But we're coming now into winter and the long hours and it's the looming of the, 18 hours a day of darkness and being confined in the house and what that can do to you mentally, to a person who is sane. And then this man who's dealing with all of the trauma from Vietnam. So I'm looking forward to getting more into that book.
All right, and how about Sarah?
I am midway through Chesapeake by James Michener, which is a very large book. It's almost perpendicular to the book you were describing, Sam. Rather than looking at a snapshot in time and various places, it takes a place and follows that place through time. So Chesapeake starts. So Michener has he wrote South Pacific, that the musical is based off of. My friend who recommended the book said South Pacific was the least favorite of them, though. But this one I really liked because we live in the Chesapeake region. So he starts in, I think, the 1400s with an Indian, Native American, and he sort of just goes through time and looks at that region and what happens. And it's historical fiction, but it's less dry than you would think for a 1,000-page book, because it's big. And then I'm also partway through Lonesome Dove, which I've been listening to on audiobook, which is another doorbuster. Door blocker.
Stopper? Door stopper.
Door stopper is the word I want. It's been a long couple weeks. But I'm enjoying it. I don't know that I've ever read a Western before. So it's pretty fun. Mm-hmm. And then I needed something kind of light this weekend at the pool, so I read Paper Towns by John Green, who did The Fault in Our Stars.
Yeah, how was that?
It was fine.
That's the only review if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, that's fine. I'd read it. I'd read another one of his novels in a year or so. I think they're young adult, and for a young adult novel, he did pretty well with the character development. And I needed something a little more poppy in comparison to the two books that I am shuffling right now. So, yeah, it was fine. Fine for the pool.
And outside of podcast novels, I am reading The Anne Rule, Stranger Beside Me. I am going to get into Lonesome Dove immediately thereafter. And I just finished Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, as well as Fabric of the Cosmos. But outside of those, I haven't been doing much in terms of novels. I've been extremely horror-heavy lately. I mean, obviously, I finished Dracula, and then finished playing... probably the scariest experience of my life was Alien Isolation. And if you play video games and you like Xenomorphs, strongly recommend this. It's utterly terrifying. Hard to play for more than an hour at a time because your heart just gets exhausted from beating as fast as it beats.
What system is this on? Is this PC? Console?
It is cross-platform. You should be able to get that on Xbox 360 and above, PS3 and above, and PC. I played it on PC. And it's the story of Amanda Ripley, Ellen Ripley's daughter, going to try and find what happened to her mom after the Nostromo blew up.
Okay.
And suffice to say, she encounters an alien creature.
Well, that sounds scary.
Yeah, it plays really well, and the artificial intelligence programmed for this creature makes it unlike, say, Resident Evil or Dead Space, where every time you walk down this corridor for the first time, this thing's going to pop out of this door. The alien creature has a mind of its own, and so you could play 10 times and not experience the same things at the same time.
Oh, wow. That
How
is kind
long
scary.
Did our 4-year-old watch you play this?
Oh, he watched for about 2 minutes, and he said, "This is too scary for me."
Yes, and now, I mean, that was a while ago, and he still references it when he wants to talk about something scary.
never forgot it.
No.
I told him, you don't want to watch me play this, dude. This is too scary. And I was walking down a corridor, and I turned the corner, and there the thing was. And I said, "Oop, he didn't see me." Whew. That's too scary for me.
It's too scary. And he made you shut it off, which was a good decision
for
a little one.
And they generally, that's the thing, they don't like scary movies, but they like scary video games.
They do.
Like
they
the do. Not really super scary ones, but they like to play, I don't know, what was that one? We played pretty much the whole, they like Portal. Portal's kind of creepy. GLaDOS always trying to come after you. But they like games that are scarier than Portal. But Alien was too much.
To, like, pause and shut off the game than it is to, like, you know, stop a movie because you're invested in the movie, but with the game, you know, you just get a retry or, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But then after that, I watched the show Dark, which I would recommend. It's pretty interesting. It's a pretty scary, got a really good tone. And so I'm actually looking to do something that might be kind of funny right now. I've already rewatched the IT Crowd. And then, of course, we missed last month's episode because the end of school and whatnot. And, of course, hockey had a little something to do with that as well.
Hockey.
Priorities.
But we're back on track now. So upcoming episodes, I've already mentioned them all, but will anybody here be joining us for Astrophysics for People in a Hurry and Fabric of the Cosmos?
I'm trying.
I am too. I got my copy from the library. I didn't get a chance to crack it open. We just had so much going on with between my husband's family and my family. We had a little bit going on, but I definitely want to get it cracked open and started. I was planning on doing that actually this weekend because I get the whole weekend. Yay.
Nice. Well, I would really like to record that episode soon. So we'll aim for that. And then, of course, Ann Rule after that. Anybody reading Stranger Beside Me?
I will.
That's the one that's about the serial killer's nonfiction, right?
Correct.
Yeah, Ted Bundy.
I may join y'all for that one. It's a little scary for my taste. I say I like vampires and scary stuff. I don't like real scary people, but like fake scary stuff I'm all over. But, you know, that one might be a little dark for me. I'll give it a try, and I'll let you know after chapter one or two.
Yeah, I agree that it's a little, a four-letter word that starts with D. Dark isn't the one I would choose. But we'll save that for the episode. Yeah. So unless anybody else has any other comments about what they've been doing lately, or Dracula, I think we can go ahead and wrap this episode up.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you guys very much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. A Novel Podcast at gmail.com or at A Novel Podcast. Look forward to hearing from you.